Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 26. I'm Strategic Analysis Australia's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by SAA's Dr. Marcus Hellyer. Marcus, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Michael.
We've had some listener feedback that I've got to speak more loudly, so I'll try to do that. And I think that might mean you have to speak more softly.
What?
So we've got a long podcast. We'll get straight into it. We've got about seven topics. We're going to talk about the trade show down in Melbourne, which seems a while ago, the Chief of Army Symposium, and a couple of interesting takeouts from that, the fantastic piece of public magic from the Defence Science and Technology Group to release a new 10-year vision. The main thing about it is it's not new.
So, am I sensing some irony there, Michael?
Well, we'll come to that.
Okay.
Yeah. More together is what it's called. Something on submarines and costs and economic impact. And the Taipan helicopter crash report, what that tells us, along with the battlefield helicopter capability gap, you know, what is the meaning of acceleration? And finish up with just a bit about the Middle East and some of the implications for us.
Okay. So you very were busy. Down, get moving.
You were down at the Land Forces trade show extravaganza, Marcus.
Saw the protesters. I didn't see Senator Shoebridge out there, but I'm sure he wasn't creating any of the mayhem.
Well, he did have the gall to turn up after there'd been some protester and police violence and sit with the Quakers who were doing a peaceful protest.
Okay.
So that was quite an inflammatory thing to sit with those Quakers.
Well, everybody has a right to peaceful protest, Michael.
You were in there, though.
I was, yes. And look, it's interesting. I always learn a lot. I know protesters are saying, what's the point of these weapons of death conventions? Well, I think the point is it provides an opportunity for people to come together and learn about other technologies, and it's an opportunity for Aussie medium to small companies to meet and greet. They can interact with the prime. So I do think it is a very useful networking opportunity. I learned a lot. I particularly learned a lot at the Army's Quantum Challenge, and I'd sort of like to congratulate Marcus Doherty, who organised it. He's a quantum researcher at the ANU, but organised it in his capacity as a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve. So well done, Marcus. I think it's always important to recognise good work by Marcuses. There's not a lot of us out there. So.
Well, and not so much good work by them. So when you see it, yeah, I agree. So congratulations to the other Marcus.
So, yeah, it was good. I do have to say, yeah, I do sort of feel a bit of the excess. You know, a lot of this is over the top. And you're going, well, this is all taxpayers' money that you're using for these huge displays.
I was talking with someone down there who was feeling a bit guilty about having some of the canapes and a nice coffee because they didn't have to pay. And I said, no, be relaxed. You are paying for it. Every taxpayer is paying for it.
Yes. Well, there was one prime, I won't name them, but their screens were enormous. And as you know, I did go and see Iron Maiden, awesome concert. I think this company's screens at the trade show were bigger than the screens in the stadium for the Iron Maiden
concert. You think they outbid Iron Maiden for the screens?
So there is a little bit of excess there, which is a little hard to take. But look, I think the trade shows are worth it. Yes, protesters have a right to protest, of course. But you know,
well, the point I've made is people that hate defence industry can have a difficult time looking at Ukraine and saying, well, the reason Putin hasn't conquered Ukraine is because of the Western countries' weapons industry.
Yes, including great little Aussie SMEs who were at this show, who, if I can sort of keep banging my drum on this, have not yet got contracts with the Australian Defence Department, despite their equipment being used on the front lines in Ukraine.
Well, that's worth protesting about. But while you were there, so the Chief of Army had his Chief of Army Symposium with a bunch of international guests and speakers, other army folk, some other academics from other countries. What did you think came out of that? Because it was following that release of that new way that the army is going to be all literal after the defence strategy.
Right. So, yeah, just before the event, the army released its new paper on the role of the Australian army in the national defence strategy. And we spoke about that. And look, the Chief Army, great speaker, you know, and you get the sense, I'm sure it's absolutely committed to the welfare of his soldiers. That's great. But some of the messages I'm a bit confused about. So he said, would we win the battle for adaptation in our region I'm not so sure. So there's his signaling, okay, we may be a little stuck in our ways. Okay, good. But then the messaging seemed to be reinforcing that the Australian Army is this very small but very professional organization.
So it's sophisticated, a bit boutique.
Yeah, yep. But small, and that's just the way it is. No sort of sense of, well, the world has changed from a world where we could get by with a small army and providing contributions to wars of choice to this new world where we could be fighting wars of survival.
Mm.
And then the next speaker was Dr. Jack Watling.
If you were fighting a war of survival, it might look more like what has had to happen in major wars like World War One and World War Two, where your small boutique peacetime army has a main job growing a bigger army.
Correct. So it was interesting that Chief of Army started by, so the new concept is about amphibiosity, and so he, you know, makes lots of references to history, which I like as a historian, and he referred back to World War II and said the Australian Army was conducting amphibious operations on an arc from the Solomons through to Borneo. And you go, yeah, but that army was huge compared to our current army.
That wasn't 30,000 people.
A quarter of the population we have today.
Yeah, it wasn't 30,000 people and shrinking.
You know, and so it grew very rapidly. So then Jack Watling from RUSI UK, who has been following the war in Ukraine very closely, spent a lot of time on the ground in Ukraine, spoke, and it was sort of very different messages. He said that the big question is, how do you grow quickly? How do you go from a small professional army to a mass army, particularly when a lot of your small professional army has been wiped out in the first stages of the war? And so the questions are, what do you do when you don't have time to train people? How do you get the most of the civilian skill sets that you're bringing into the army? So it was a very, very different question set.
And obviously, how do you mobilize your industry and economy behind that to equip and support this bigger force? Yes. And he spoke straight after the Chief of Army, didn't he? And you've got to think that's a very incongruous, stark contrast in messages. You know, Doug, I'm here to tell you that I think the Chief of Army said the nature of war hasn't changed, its character has, whatever that distinction might mean. And then my plan is to have a really tightly professional, beautifully equipped, tiny army that can be agile. And when it's dealing with bigger foes in the region, the fact it's so agile would be what matters. And then you hear from the next guy who's studying an actual war where a bigger enemy, Russia, is trying to conquer a smaller one, Ukraine. And Ukraine has had to mobilize and expand its military massively. That, to me, is a lesson worth listening to.
Well, yes, the overall message I got from Chief Army was a bit along the lines of, you can do all the agile adapting you like as long as it's within the framework of a very small, hyper-professional army.
Well, you've got to think, so he doesn't have a vision that he might have to expand the army beyond this tiny professional force, and he's got a concern in his mind about whether our army would win the war of adaption in our region. So if he's not confident they're going to win a war of adaption and he's got no plans to expand, what is his plan if there's war rather than just maintaining a boutique peacetime army?
Well, maybe DST's going to save us, Michael, because in the this relentless delivery of strategic planning documents that we're getting from out of defence, we've had another one drop, which is the latest Defence Science and Technology strategic high-level document, which you've gone through in some detail. So what are your impressions?
Well, I think it's wonderful to see so much continuity. With so much turbulence and change happening in the world in the last 4 years, I'm really reassured that the Defence Science and Technology Group, under the leadership of the incumbent Chief Defence Scientist, Tanya Munro, has generated continuity.
So what you're saying is agile adaptation has led us to be doing more of the same thing.
Well, there's some brilliance in what she and her organisation have done. So in 2020, they released a 10-year plan called More Together, the Defence Science and Technology Strategy.
Hang on, More Together, isn't that the name of the new one?
But this is 2020. More Together, the Defence Science and Technology Strategy for 2030. All the things that they had to achieve between 2020 and 2030.
And what have they achieved? So we're 4 years in. What have they delivered?
They've released a new strategy.
Okay.
Four years on.
And does that set out what they've done in the last 4 years?
What it has done, I think, is show the wisdom. Because one of the things about the previous strategy was they had to anticipate the future. And I think they've really achieved that, because this strategy released 4 years later is just like the one that they released in 2020. They have anticipated that future by releasing the same strategy.
That's amazing.
And in fact...
And they also anticipated the title as well.
They did. This
because
one...
Because it's
so the
same
one,
title.
The other one was called More Together.
Yeah.
This one is called Accelerating Asymmetric Advantage, Delivering More Together.
Okay.
And what it does is set out a 10-year vision that now goes from 2024 to 2034.
Okay.
And it says the same things that defence science were going to achieve by 2030 will now be achieved by 2034.
Right. So,
but in a way that's accelerated our asymmetric advantage.
It's right, hang on. So if we go back all the way to 2020, More Together set out, I think, six what they were calling star shots. What's happened to the star shots?
Well, I don't think that's quite that clear, but they had their key priorities. There were nine technologies, exemplar list of nine technologies. I'll just give some of them. Trusted autonomy, mm-hmm. cyber, quantum, hypersonics, directed energy, and space.
All right, and what's the list this time around?
Hypersonics, directed energy, trusted autonomy, quantum, information warfare, and long-range fires. So,
well, I think that just shows how their vision back in 2020, that they got it right back in 2020, because it's the same list in 2024.
Well, I thought then I did start to have a few little doubts when I read the 2024 document, because I couldn't see any actual delivery against these same priorities that have been in place for 4 years.
Well, don't we have a hypersonic missile in service now?
Well, there was a picture in the 2020 strategy mm-hmm. of a high-fire test, which is a hypersonic
Because back in 2020, we'd already been doing a cooperative hypersonic program with the US for well over a decade.
Yes.
So presumably in the last 4 years, we've taken that foundation and turned it into a weapon?
No, because I don't think it had yet been accelerated for asymmetric advantage.
Oh, right.
That is to happen over the next 10 years.
Okay, so the next 10 years is the acceleratification.
Yes.
Okay.
So the things that were going to be done by 2030 will now be accelerated and delivered by 2034.
Okay. And good.
One other really good thing, I think you can always tell the quality of a document and how impactful it is going to be.
Because it gets bigger?
Yes. The 2020 document was only about 22 pages.
Oh, that's lame.
The new one is approaching 60.
Well, that's more like it.
So there's double the wordification, and I think that speaks to the intensity of the intent.
Now, I do have to say, you know...
Oh, sorry, I just have to finish on this, which is, if I'd been doing the title for this, I think it was a stroke of genius to add delivering out the front of More Together.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look at it being the same plan as the 2020 plan, but 4 years delayed, I would have called it Delivering More Together Later.
You're so rude, Michael, so rude. But, yes... How many big chunky strategic documents have we now had under this government? I mean, have we hit double figures yet? I'm not quite sure. But
well, I suppose we've had the Defence Strategic Review, the Surface Combatant Review.
Mm-hmm. National Defence Strategy.
National Defence Strategy, the this IOP. One, acceleration of delivering more together later. Well, and a promise of another defence strategy in 2 years with another revision of the investment plan. So the tempo of document creation and release is really accelerating.
I think we are certainly beating the adversary into submission through weight of documentation at this point.
So I would encourage the chief defence scientist to put a short document out saying what they have achieved over their tenure and in the 4 years since that first accelerification.
That would
plan.
Be very nice. Okay, so also we've had a few little snippets back in submarine land. We try not to spend every episode focused on submarines, but it's a bit hard to avoid it. But a bit of news out of the US. So guess what? The cost of the latest two US Navy Virginia submarines has gone up by a lazy 20%. So it's gone from $9.4 billion.
That makes me think, is there a reason to expect this cost escalation to be slowing? Because I remember before COVID, the cost of complex military equipment like submarines routinely grew much faster than most other cost indices.
So, yes, well, I guess that just means we should be expecting these things to go up a lot.
So the U.S. Navy is going to have to ask Congress for more money.
It's asking Congress for more money.
But it's got a cunning plan, hasn't
it? It has got a cunning plan. So it's the SOARS proposal, the Shipyard Accountability and Workforce Support Proposal, which seems to be asking Congress for a pot of money to cover kind of general shipyard expenses. So rather than sort of getting money just for individual boats, they would get a big chunk of money to cover running the shipyard.
Which, just stuff that they need to do anyway, regardless of whether they're building something.
Yeah, you know, which kind of makes congressperson, sense. Kind of makes sense, but on the other hand, it does make it hard to work out the cost of any individual ship.
But that's where
that does describe our system, because there's no way for us in Australia to know exactly what defence is paying for any individual
ship. Well, this is
ship.
Where the proposal, to me, its name tells you where the trouble starts. It's called the Shipyard Accountability and Workforce Support Proposal. There will be less accountability.
You're saying it's the Shipyard Accountability Obfuscation.
Yes, unaccountability. Proposal. Because instead of knowing how much it costs you to build submarines, you'll have this amorphous running cost thing, and then you'll have a price for a submarine that isn't reflective of the price of production.
Well, they've actually taken the Australian model, Michael.
Well, we haven't built anything for some time. I'm not sure our model is best practice.
So also in SSN land, a couple of U.S. Navy contracts have hit the news relating to submarines. The first one is a large contract to the Blue Forge Alliance.
Yeah, presumably the Blue Forge Alliance. So this is $950 million, isn't it? They must be. Mm-hmm. Like that forge thing makes it sound like they're a heavy industry player.
Well, I've tried to work out what the Blue Forge Alliance actually does, and it seems to be a job advertisement site where it aggregates job vacancies from across the shipbuilding industry. Other than that, it's a bit hard to see what they do.
It might be more
nice
like
work
a,
for a cool $1 billion.
Might be more like a labour hire or professional service provider outfit. So not a lot of forging going on there.
Bit hard to know, but the good bit is we're paying for it.
Oh.
Because the contract announcement says that it is coming from US Navy funds and foreign partner funds.
Including foreign partner funds. And the only foreign partner in the AUKUS treaty that was signed recently that is enabled to pay the other partners, the UK and the US, is Australia.
So, yes, our roughly $4.7 billion contribution to the US for SSNs does seem to somehow help cover the cost of this job advertisement site.
The Blue Forge. But there was another contract, wasn't there, that the US military led?
Yes, with Deloitte's. And this is an even bigger contract.
Yeah, Deloitte's are one of the big four consultancy outfits.
Go there, Michael.
And defence was spending about $2 billion a year on the big four until the PricewaterhouseCoopers scandal struck. So we've been trying to reduce how much we're spending on these big four. Is this like that the toothpaste tube where you squeeze down one part of the tube and the other part pops
this
up?
It's different, Michael. Very different.
So spending the money on Deloitte's in America is different to spending it on the big four here.
This is a $2.4 billion contract.
US?
Yes, US. So about 3.5 in Pacific pesos. And it is quote, for a requirement to establish an enterprise integration partner. Integration, you love that word,
and
Michael.
Enterprise, too.
To deliver wait for it, systemic.
Yes.
Holistic. There you go. It's got to be a holistic solutions to regional and broader submarine industrial workforce and industrial-based challenges.
Well, that sounds good. It sounds like
I'm not quite sure what that is.
But they've nailed it down, obviously. They must have nailed the requirement down pretty tightly.
Well, it also says cost-type contract is being used as the requirement is difficult to define sufficiently for a fixed-price type contract. So that means we sort of have very ill-defined requirement for something to do with the submarine industrial base, and here's $2.4 billion US to do something holistic.
So $950 million US to Blue Forge, $2.4 billion US to Deloitte's, and we seem to be getting holistic, synergistic helpification around a poorly defined but very big, nasty problem.
Yes.
Right.
There we go.
Well, look, I know you wrote a piece recently on SAA talking about how building nuclear submarines is not a positive economic thing. But I challenge you, sir, Deloitte's getting $2.4 billion. That's putting a lot of meals on tables. Blue Forge getting $950 million. And the lovely thing is it's Australian economic stimulus of the American economy. So there's American jobs here.
Yeah, look, I wrote a piece. Essentially, it was therapy for myself because I was so annoyed at all of the grifters saying the SSNs are going to promote economic growth in Australia. And it's like, there is no way it can. It just does not happen like that. As a big fan of defence industry and defending Australia, as you are, somebody who's advocated for more defence spending it here in Australia. We are big advocates of defence spending, but the bottom line is, the underlying truth is, it does not promote economic growth.
Well, I am actually not a fan of defence spending unless it is spent for a very good purpose with very good value for money. I think we should spend as little as possible on defence, but that means we have to spend it extremely well.
Correct. The key criteria to assess defence spending is, does it deliver capability and make us safer? We need to cut through all of the bogus flim-flammery about somehow SSNs are about jobs and growth.
Well, I would say if you're spending $765 billion over the next 10 years on defence, and you've got a chief of army who's saying he's not sure we could win the war of adaption in our region, that's an indicator the money's not being spent well. And you do not spend a single dollar of the defence budget to create jobs and growth.
No. All right. So anyway, that piece is up on the SAA website. All right. Next item. We're moving along pretty rapidly here, Michael. Yep. Taipan crash report. So
it's out. Now, this is the report into the Jarvis Bay crash.
The first crash, which
not the fatal crash in Queensland.
Fortunately, no one was killed in this crash, and I don't think anyone was very seriously injured either. But, okay, first takeaway from this, why was this report released? In fact, it's only the executive summary that was released.
Well, I would expect the reason this crash investigation report was released publicly is that air safety is improved by public transparency because people need to know what the causes of air accidents were so they can prevent them.
I would agree, but it was not voluntarily released by the Australian government.
Oh.
Senator Malcolm Roberts actually
got
a Senate order.
Former minister in the defence portfolio. Yeah. Right. So he had to force the government to release a crash investigation report.
Well, the executive summary of it. Yes.
Only the,
well done, Malcolm Roberts. Unusual individual, but sometimes he actually delivers some useful stuff. Now, I guess when I read the summary, first thing is it must have been absolutely terrifying for the people involved. Yeah. So it is nighttime operation. The helicopter is recovering divers from the water. So it's flying along with divers suspended from the helicopter.
Dangling from ropes from the helicopter at night.
Flying low, and one of the engines fails. So it must have been absolutely terrifying. Mm. First point is, this engine was one that had a defect that was well known. So Eurocopter had advised the operators to replace the rotor blades in these engines 4 years earlier.
4 years earlier.
And the Australian Army had not replaced the rotors on all of the fleet.
Well, I think also the warning from the helicopter manufacturer was that you could have a failure of this nature in this kind of activity. So their whole point was you need to replace the turbine blades if you want to do this kind of activity. And the Army, in its maintenance program, hadn't got around to doing all the aircraft in 4 years, and they used one of the aircraft that didn't have the fix at this time.
Yeah, so that seems a little peculiar. And then the engine failed, and the helicopter touched the water, apparently, but the other engine kept going and kept the aircraft in a hover. So quite remarkably, the helicopter sort of survived the initial failure. But then what happened? Oh, the air crew in the back tried to release the divers.
Yes.
Half of them are released and half of them are still dangling underneath this helicopter. So
this is all happening in seconds.
Happening in seconds. And even though the helicopter is hovering, one of the pilots removed their helmet so couldn't communicate with the rest of the crew, and the flying pilot at that point turned the one remaining engine off. And
well, who knows? They may have thought they're already They'd already hit the water and were down.
So, well, the first pilot to take their helmet off thought they were actually in the water.
Right.
And I guess you've got spray everywhere. It's nighttime.
Yeah.
Anyway, so of course, when you turn the one remaining engine off, the helicopter crashes and apparently hit the water at 8G.
That's an enormous impact, isn't it? So you would expect fatalities from that kind of impact.
You know, incredibly scary event. Amazing, no fatalities. As you know, we've had this very long, probably 20-year saga now of the MRH-90 Taipan supporters and the MRH-90 Taipan haters.
Haters have got to hate, the lovers have got to love.
And I think any, regardless of where you stand on that, you're going to look at this report and go, see, I was right. So if you're a hater, you're going to go, well, the engine failed, terrible helicopter. If you're a supporter, you would say, well, the engine failed, but it still hovered, it survived on that one.
And there was a fix available that should have been put in place.
Fix available should have been done, and it crashed at HG, and everybody survived. And
well, one sort of Tony Blair third way message I would have, not being a lover or a hater of the Taipan, is there a problem with such complex systems that you get a problem that's 4 years old that your complex maintenance and upgrade system can't put in place? And so is a simpler helicopter a better solution here?
Maybe, but is the problem the complexity of the aircraft or the problem the inability of the operating organisation to maintain it properly?
It's a tango, isn't it, between, you know, smart people with smart machines, but is it too big a burden with the increasing complexity of multiple systems in our military's hands to expect them to be dealing with that proliferation of technical complexity, allegedly for incredible operational advantage?
So anyway, so my friend Kim Bergman has put a piece out already in the Australia Pacific Defence Reporter saying, see, I told you so, MRH-90 is a great helicopter.
Well,
so
I hope we're going to see.
I don't think this settles anything.
I hope we're going to see the crash report from the actual fatal crash, because back to my point, you do not improve aviation safety by hiding in crash investigation reports.
No, I would hope that we see that report.
And I'd hope we see it
without the Senate actually having to order the government to release it.
And I would also hope that we see it before the replacement aircraft, the Blackhawks, turn up, because this is a case of the Princess Bride again, where, you know, the pirate keeps catching up with the abducted princess and her kidnappers. And that one of the kidnappers, the ringleader, keeps looking back saying it's inconceivable, until eventually Andre the Giant, one of the kidnappers, says, you keep saying that word, but I don't think it means what you think it means.
I do not think this word means what you think it means, yes.
So there's been
one of the great quotable quotes from a great movie. Yes, so that gets us to the Black Hawk helicopter, which we've spoken about before. We've written about it and posted on SAA before. So if we cast our minds back to the second Taipan crash last year, the government essentially decided to permanently ground the MRH-90.
For safety reasons, I think they said. And you've got to think, so does this first crash report tell us it was unsafe or not? Anyway, so yes, they grounded the whole fleet. They did, I think, what Tony Abbott said about the about work choices, you know, it was cremated, dead and buried. They cut up the helicopters and buried them. And then there were fantastic alliance sentiments, I think, from Richard Marles, the Deputy Prime Minister, who also, I think, is still the Defence Minister, and his Pentagon counterpart, Secretary Austin. Can you remind us what happened?
So at the time the Taipans were grounded, we had already decided to replace them with Blackhawks, but we only had three Blackhawks. And so some annoying commentators, such as myself, said, we now have this glaring battlefield helicopter gap, to which Mr. Miles said, don't worry, we're accelerating the delivery of Blackhawks.
And he raised this directly Secretary Austin.
And I have a quote here from Secretary Austin saying, the Defense Department, US Defense Department, is accelerating delivery of Blackhawk helicopters to Australia. And Mr. Miles said, Australia is, quote, enormously grateful to the US for speeding the delivery of Blackhawks. This is something that we really appreciate and is, again, an example of America standing up in a moment which we really need it.
Yes, the moment was clear. So they were going to be accelerated. And I think that that's very achievable, because the Black Hawk production line is a well-oiled machine. They're popping out lots for the US and other international customers. So we've probably got that whole new fleet by now. What, 40 helicopters? How many do we have?
Close. 8.
Okay. We're eight short of the 40. We've got 32.
No, we have eight. We've gone in the past year from 3 to 8.
But that's obviously faster than we would have planned before, because Richard Miles achieved that result with the Pentagon head. So the Army, if there's a test here, the Army would be flying more air hours now than they'd planned before this acceleration, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, about that. So according to the defense budget documents, in 23-24, so the immediate past
last
budget year,
yeah,
we were planning to fly 1,500 Black Hawk hours.
That was before the acceleration.
That was before the acceleratification.
So how many were flown?
880.
More than 880, more than 1,500?
No, 880. So
about half.
Yeah, a bit more than half.
Yeah, so that word acceleration may not mean
this
what we
word,
think it means.
I do not think this word means what you think it means. Look, okay, we can make fun of this, but two big points. First is we still have a massive helicopter capability gap. I don't know how you do amphibious operations off LHDs without helicopters to carry your troops. I don't know how the Defence Force helps out in the impending bushfire season without a fleet of helicopters.
How does the Special Forces do counterterrorism operations?
Shh, don't mention that. The other big question is, how does Army's existing aircrew, both pilots, the people in the back of the helicopters, the maintainers, how do they maintain their skills when they don't have helicopters?
Well, and if you're a helicopter pilot or crew and you don't have helicopters to fly, why do you stay around? So that recruitment and retention crisis, I wonder what the stats look like for helicopter air crew and also technical support.
I would be very interested to know. But the other big takeaway from this is, look, this, we've spoken about capability transitions before. We've put pieces up on the SAA website. They're always difficult and challenging. You're always probably going to have a bit of a dip in capability. But here, this should have been a very relatively simple transition from an existing in-service capability with a global support network to a new capability that is existing, mature, in-service,
robust,
hot production line,
yeah,
and we seem to have no capability. So looking forward perhaps to another capability transition, perhaps from conventional submarines to nuclear-powered submarines, where we're relying on our US ally to stand up and help us, not a great precedent, I have to say.
Also, with the Black Hawks, there are thousands of these things in service, thousands being manufactured. Getting 40 fast should be eminently achievable compared to winkling out nuclear-powered submarines when the Americans have very, very few. So it is a disturbing indicator of American defense industrial weakness.
Mm-hmm. And that they can say all they like how much they want to help us.
Yeah, it was a touching moment when Secretary Austin and Richard Miles looked soulfully into each other's eyes and we were going to get accelerated helicopters, but it just didn't happen.
But that is also the discourse around SSNs.
Yeah.
So the advocates of SSNs in Australia say, well, every senior US leader has guaranteed they will deliver us submarines.
Yeah, they've looked into each other's eyes. So we better end just with a quick thing about the Middle East and the enormously disturbing vulnerabilities in every electronic system that people put their hands on. So old tech, pagers being used as lethal weapon. The Israelis haven't said they're responsible, but there aren't too many other people on the planet,
I
A, that have the motive,
that,
B, that can do it.
I read one thing where a senior Israeli denied it was actually them. It's like, okay.
But Putin uses denials to demonstrate his power. Like, no, no, I'm not at war in Ukraine. No, no, I didn't kill that dissident in Berlin.
Mm. Anyway, look, we can argue about is this a form of deterrence? Is it going to escalate? You're going to have different views on this depending on where you broadly stand on the whole Israel-Palestine issue. So we won't sort of go into that huge debate. But I think the big takeaway there is, once again, supply chain security, that if you don't sort of control or at least understand your supply chains, you are creating huge vulnerabilities for yourself.
Well, and the obvious thing to say about that is nobody has complete supply chain security. In fact, there was a report out about American weapon systems with the proliferation of Chinese parts and subcomponents and electronics in even key American platforms. Things like the F-35,
and
things
Aegis,
like their aircraft carriers, Aegis.
So systems that we rely on.
Yes. And after years where the big defence primes have been told this is a problem, they're still there.
Yeah, I mean, the remarkable thing about the attack on Hezbollah is, yes, the discussion has sort of focused on, gosh, there's all of this software and processes and electronic components in all of our systems. The bad guys might put some sneaky backdoor in, some sneaky software. This is... they've actually put explosives in there. It's kind of very old-fashioned. It's a James Bond kind of thing on industrial scale.
And to me, it looks like Hezbollah contracted with Israeli intelligence agencies to buy the pages that then killed them.
You do have to say they don't seem to have done due diligence.
No, I think this is worth writing about because you look at the war in Ukraine, both sides, the Ukrainians and the Russians, are using Chinese technology, whether it's Mavic drones or just components and modules. So we live in a world where if you end up fighting a war, you might need to use adversary tech and adversary supplies. And the question is, how can you do that in safety?
Yep. One quick last number. I've mentioned before, Defence has refused to give me the approved budget for the Hunter-class frigate program, yeah. Now that they've signed a contract for the build of the first three. For whatever reason, the Australian Senate has more pull than I do, so Defence has responded to a question on notice.
Well, this is good, because normally Defence likes to wriggle out of responding to Senate questions.
They have provided the number. So the approval for the Hunter-class frigate program before they started construction was $7.25 billion.
Yep.
There's now been an additional $19.87 billion for the construction of the first three
ships. So we're getting up
ships.
To 26.
Yeah, 26, 27 billion.
For the first three plus setup costs.
Plus some setup costs, some training, support system stuff. So if you go, all right, that's for the first three, we're going to get six. We sort of take off, you know, some of the one-off costs, but then we escalate for inflation. You've got to figure the next three are going to cost at least $20 billion due to inflation. So I think the entire budget of $45 billion that was meant to be for nine, gone, all going to go on six.
I think you've underdone it. On those figures, it'll be over 45. It'll be 46 more.
So we've gone from nine boats for $30 billion to nine boats for $35 billion to nine boats for $45 billion to six boats for something over $45 billion.
And the other big issue for me there is, so all of that money included building the world's best digitized automated shipyard, which could pop these things out really fast. But it turns out we're getting them at a tempo where we could have been building them in a, you know, 1865 shipyard or a 1900s shipyard. So all that automation doesn't appear to result in ships turning up to the Navy anytime soon.
Well, let me just correct you there, Michael, because that number of $45 billion does not cover the cost of the shipyard. That's separate money managed by the Department of Finance.
Sorry, my apologies. I thought for $45 billion we might get the shipyard as well.
No, that's it. So, yes, you are quite right in saying we now have what is claimed to be the world's most advanced, automated, modern shipyard. We are still spending inordinate amounts of money. The drumbeat, according to the response to the Quan, the delivery drumbeat, is still 2 to 3 years per ship. We've actually gone from, we were hoping to get them every 2 years, but now it's every 2 to 3 years. So we're not going to get the sixth ship until the second half of the 2040s. So all I can say is I hope and pray that the general purpose frigate program will deliver some ships, because if it doesn't, we are not going to have a surface fleet.
I can't help but remember that continuous shipbuilding was started by the Australian Defence Department convincing the then government it was a great idea for two reasons. One, it was going to reduce the costs to get the Navy ships. Figures I heard tossed about were $30 billion savings. That obviously was a gross error. In fact, it's costing more. The other thing was, so the continuous shipbuilding program needs to be run at a tempo for defence industry, not for the Navy. And since then, we've had our security environment deteriorate extremely rapidly year on year, and we're still stuck with a shipbuilding program for the Navy that is defined by the economics of a tiny little industry rather than the needs of our security and our Navy.
Well, the fundamental problem in our continuous naval shipbuilding enterprise is the first thing we did was to stop continuous naval shipbuilding by ending the air warfare destroyer program and then essentially having a massive 10-year gap,
sure,
in shipbuilding.
Sure, but there is no excuse for spending $45 billion plus billions more on the world's best, fastest shipyard and delivering ships on a 2 to 3 year tempo when things are urgent.
I could not agree more, Michael.
I think we're out of time, but thank you for covering a lot of ground. Episode 26 is at an end.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to our listeners.